Come to order. For February 15th, the Committee of Environment and Natural Resources. First thing on the agenda, we are going to accept the minutes for the February 8th meeting. If members could look over the minutes. Would anybody like to move those minutes? Representative Breinart.
I'll move the minutes, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Breinart moves the minutes of February 8th, 2007. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed? Motion prevails. The minutes have been adopted. The first thing on the agenda today, we are going to be hearing some bills. The first one is House File 587, Representative Bly. If you'd step forward, please, and I will move House File 587 to be recommended to pass. Representative Bly, thank you for joining us. Please present your bill for us.
Thank you, Chair. I also want to, I have Kent Lockett Snow from the DNR. I thought I murdered your name, Bill. Okay. Anyway, he will be helping me with this if there are any questions. First of all, I do have an amendment, delete all amendments. I think you received a copy of the replacement language.
And do we have the number of the amendment? Okay. I'll move amendment A070070, Representative Bly.
Thank you. There was some, the reason for the amendment was there was some confusion about what the purpose of this bill was, and it involves a hearing notice and publication of that hearing notice, and makes it possible for the initiator of the hearing to publish a summary as opposed to the full report. Kent helped me understand this and brought to my attention that it used to be that they could publish summaries of hearings before the fact so that people who were interested could know what they were about, and then they were in addition to that was published a place where they could get a full copy of the details of the hearing, and then after a decision made by the Attorney General's office, they were required to publish the whole information for the hearing. And you can see here in a document that the yellow parts would be what might be included in the summary, and the rest is all what they're having to publish now. And I understand this is in the interest of making it more affordable for the DNR and also somebody else who might initiate the hearing to be able to afford to do that. It's fairly costly to get something like this published in a newspaper. I'm told it could go anywhere from $500 to $900, which could actually be kind of could exclude some people from going forward. So that's the gist of the motion or the bill. And if you have any questions, I'd invite Ken to either add to my testimony and but answer questions as well.
Okay, first of all, I'd like to renew the motion for the amendment A070070. All those in favor of the amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? Motion prevails. Amendment is adopted. Mr. Lockesmo.
Mr. Chairman and members, my name is Kent Lockesmo. I'm the director of the Division of Waters for DNR. I can just give you a little bit of background. When we take a permit action, either issue a permit or issue a restoration order, a party receiving that could demand a hearing if they are aggrieved by our decision. And that process is a Chapter 14 hearing. There's specific rules and processes set forth in Chapter 14 that spell out how we go through that process. This bill does not change any of that process or the notice required under Chapter 14. And the Chapter 14 notice is the lengthy notice that Representative Bly held up. And what we were seeking to do with this bill is to allow for an abbreviated notice to be published in the paper. As you'll see in this amendment, in lines 1.12, or 1.11 and 1.12. The cost of this hearing notice is the it's done at the expense of the applicant. And we've got the copy that we held up was $562.04. I also have examples here of $748 and $898. That's all at the expense of the applicant. So this makes no difference to the DNR as far as any financial implications. It's a cost that's borne by the applicant. And I'm not sure how many people read these lengthy legals in the paper, but our proposal would have it. And the Chapter 14 hearing process does not require publication. This is only a DNR requirement in 103G that actually requires the publication of the notice. The Chapter 14 notice is a notice that's provided to the administrative law judge and the applicant or the violator or whoever, and a short list of parties, the litigants in a proceeding, not to the whole general public. So we thought this was just a little bit of a good government bill. We can hold down the costs. And I suppose we've had some staff that have said if the costs are higher, maybe we'd have less hearing demands. But really, we aren't afraid of going to hearing. If that's somebody's choice, they should be able to do that, and we shouldn't have cost be a factor. We want to get the right facts in front of an administrative law judge and make decisions. This amendment came about because the administrative law judge had some questions on how it was written and whether or not the full notice under Chapter 14 would still be required. So this clarifies that, and I think it takes care of it. Still meets our needs, and it meets their needs, so this is just a better way to accomplish the same purpose with the amendment. And I'll stand for questions.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Lockesmo. Any questions from the members? Seeing none, I renew my motion that House File 587, as amended, be recommended to pass. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? Motion prevails. Bill is passed. Thank you, Representative Block, Mr. Block, this moment. And next on the agenda, we have House File 577. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We have before us today House File 577 dealing with buffers along drainage ditches. And I have a series of amendments. I'd like to move House File 577.
Okay. And would you move House File 577? And
I move House File 577 or upon passage referral to local government committee.
Okay. And Representative Hackbar.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Chairman, is this bill going to other committees besides local government? Is it going to be taking a stop in the Hague committee?
I can answer that question.
Representative Hansen.
Representative McNamara, or Hackbar. I've talked to the Representative Junkie, and I've talked to Representative Otremba. They are aware of the bill at this time. They did not see a need to hear it. If something comes up, they keep their options open on that. I think you will see something being handed out here with the farm groups being in favor of House File 577, and I think that's part of why they haven't asked for it yet. And I am keeping in constant communication with them.
Well, Mr. Chairman,
Representative Hackbar,
I think as we hear the testimony on this bill, we'll find out that it has to do with farm property and owners of farm or agricultural land. And I really believe that the Agricultural Committee should look at this. Maybe Chairman Junkie doesn't want to see this bill, but maybe the members of this committee do. So as we hear testimony, I would recommend that this bill does make a stop in the Ag Committee.
Okay, well, we're going to be sending it to local government if it moves out of here, and the determination can be made at that point whether it should proceed on to the Ag Committee. Any other questions before we proceed? Mr. Representative Hansen.
Mr. Chair, I do have an author's amendment, number 807-0058, and I'd like to move that, and then I have a couple of subsequent amendments that have been brought to me to get the bill into the shape that I'd like it to.
Representative Hansen moves amendment A07-0058. Any discussion on the amendment? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? Motion prevails. Amendment is adopted. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then I would like to, Representative Wagenius has brought me an amendment, A070072. And I believe the procedure for this, I'd like to incorporate that into the language that we just passed as the amendment. So I would move amendment A070072.
Representative Hansen moves amendment A07-0072. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Amendment is adopted. Representative Hansen.
And then I just want the previous amendment, and then this amendment I have also checked with the Board of Water and Soil Resources and other folks. I'd like to move A070074.
Representative Hansen moves amendment A07-0074. Representative Hackbarth.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and we're moving through the amendments without any explanation of any of the amendments. I would hope that the author of these amendments are going to explain these once we get these all adopted and get them still in the shape that he likes.
There will be an explanation. It's normal procedure that the author is allowed to amend the bill at their first stop to get it in the shape that the author would like. So the discussion on the amendments will take place once that's been accomplished. So, Representative Hansen.
I renew my motion to amend by amending with A070074.
Representative Hansen renews his motion to pass amendment A07-0074. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed? Motion prevails. Amendment is adopted. Representative Hansen to the bill as amended.
Yes, and I have with me today Doug Thomas with the Board of Water and Soil Resources as we walk through the bill as amended. The bill has language and policy language that is part of the governor's budget initiative. The Board of Water and Soil Resources will go through the bill, and then when we get to the finance portion, then I'll discuss the differences between 577 and the budget governor's budget request. So with that, Mr. Thomas, if you could.
Mr. Thomas.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, Doug Thomas, Board of Water and Soil Resources. I'd like to just walk through and provide a summary of each one of the sections of the bill that you have in front of you today, and I'll also try to pick up and mention where each one of the amendments that were offered fit into the bill. Section 1 of the bill deals with allowing perennial vegetation approved by the Drainage Authority. Basically, that change prior to this, the law simply said grass strips, and that very narrowly interpreted, the only thing that could be planted out there would be grass, as we commonly think of it. So we're recommending the change to perennial vegetation, which allows a broader choice of things to be planted out there. It also recognizes that in northern Minnesota, many of the ditches go through wooded and forested areas, and it actually acknowledges and would allow that to be continued to be, under the law, a permissible vegetation along those ditches in those kinds of situations. And so we think that helped. The biggest changes in Section 1 are what really started the whole effort. It clarifies the point of beginning of where you measure the buffer strip from, and we presented a lot of that information to the committee a couple of weeks ago. Basically, it's using the language from the top edge of the constructed channel rather than the top of the bank, and that's a much more easy and clearer means for somebody going out in the field, whether it's a drainage inspector, viewer, county commissioner, drainage authority, to basically determine where is that point of beginning for where the strip is measured from. The third thing that Section 1 does is also addresses the issue of the width of buffers, and it makes a distinction between the width of the buffer that's required when there's construction activity occurring, either new construction, an improvement, or a major repair, which requires the appointment of viewers to do redetermination benefits and damages, from a proceeding which is only a redetermination of benefits and damages where there is no construction activity taking place. And so it makes a very clear distinction between those two and a clear understanding of how that width of the buffer strip is measured in those cases. The amendment that you have, 070058, would add on section one, where it talks about, or no. Okay, it, where before it said in the Hansen Amendment that preference should be given to planting species native to the project area, it would be preference should be given to planting native species of a local ecotype, and so it makes that correction. And that was on page line 117, where the Hansen Amendment would insert that sentence after the period the period ending after ditch and before the words the approved. You would insert a sentence then that would read, preference should be given to planting species or planting native species of a local ecotype. And so that is section one of the bill. Moving on to section two of the bill. Section two and three actually are just simply conforming changes. It removes the word grass and inserts it with vegetation and permanent to conform to the change that was created in section one. Moving on to section four. Section four is a new section of the bill in terms of 103B and in terms of a new change. And what that does is it provides for a new subdivision in the drainage law, which allows for the incremental implementation of ditch buffer strips inside inlet controls. And what it really does is it provides an enhanced authority to establish and maintain buffer strips in those side inlet controls where they've been determined to be needed for purposes of water quality or maintaining the efficiency of the ditch system. Basically, it would support and improve the maintenance by moving the farming operations back and eliminating a lot of potential erosion and sedimentation getting into the ditch, which could require more frequent maintenance on the part of the drainage authority. It requires the same point of beginning that would be required for how the grass buffer strip would be measured. It would require to continue to utilize the same repair procedures, which require the same kind of public notice opportunity for all the affected landowners along that system. Give some ability for the drainage authority to appoint an engineer rather than viewers to help try to make that a bit more of a streamlined process. Does require for the determination of damages. So people are, they go through that formal process, and every affected landowner where that buffer strip will then be installed is compensated through the payment of damages. And then it utilizes, again, like I said, the due process, which is this similar to what's currently in drainage law for other types of drainage proceedings. Section 5 of the bill. With the Hansen Amendment, Section 5 becomes a new Section 5. And it's
excuse me, Mr. Thomas. Representative Hackbarth has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Could you point out exactly where it says that the landowner is reimbursed?
Let's see here. Chairman, Representative Hackbarth, basically it's on the bottom of page 2, starting on page line 29. Damages shall be determined by the drainage authority, and then the damage statement, that's a statement that identifies the cost per property associated with the drainage ditch that is being worked on, how those damages, which is again, that's the estimate of what it would take to acquire that 16 and a half foot strip of property and the cost to seed it down if the seeding were to be done by the landowners, and that is something that is can be done either way. And then that is filed with the auditor, and then it's at that point then that the auditor provides payment back to those individual landowners for the damages that they're being awarded for that 16 and a half foot strip of land that is being acquired for the grass buffer strip by the Drainage Authority.
So, Mr. Chairman,
Representative Hackbar.
Elsewhere in law it says that if the landowner does not comply with this, that there's a lien put on their property, and that the Drainage Authority can come in and take care of this issue if the property owner doesn't do it. So how do we compensate that issue? I mean, is the property owner going to be liened then, and then he's going to have to apply to get reimbursed, or how is that going to work?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hackbarth, the first step in this process is the landowner is compensated through the payment of damages, where they may come in and say the value of that land is $2,000 an acre, and this is how many acres that 16 and a half foot buffer strip is going to consume. A payment is made equivalent to that value that is determined through this process. Once that's there, then the landowner has an obligation to maintain or to leave that grass buffer strip intact. If there's an encroachment of that grass buffer strip, that's when the Drainage Authority can, through their regular maintenance and inspection activities, identify that there's been an encroachment or a violation by the landowner of plowing into, tilling up, or somehow or another encroaching on that 16 and a half feet. Then they can order that to be restored by the landowner. If the landowner chooses not to do that, that's when this issue of they can put a lien on the property by they can basically do the work themselves, place a lien on it, and then the county assessor and the county auditor will then assess them back that cost of the Drainage Authority to replace or restore the grass buffer strip out there. And then once that's satisfied, then the lien goes away.
And Mr. Chairman, if the landowner doesn't take the first step that you mentioned to make that application, then what happens if he doesn't make that application and his pitches aren't in compliance?
Mr. Thomas.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hackbarth, I'm not sure I understand the nature of the question in that there really is not, once the Drainage Authority initiates a project, the landowner does not initiate anything. There is this formal proceeding where the viewers are appointed or an engineer is appointed. They go out, they make the determination, they provide a public notice or they provide individual notice. There's a hearing, and at that time the landowner, you know, is aware of how much they're going to be compensated for and what the buffer strip requirement is. It's only after that time is if during an inspection, a violation of that, say they plowed right back to the edge of the ditch, the 16 and a half feet isn't there anymore. They've been compensated for that 16 and a half feet. And so then the Drainage Authority would potentially, they could send a notice and say, you've got the rest of this year to plant that back to grass, and if you don't do it, we'll come out and do it for you, and then we'll basically charge you back through putting a lien and then having that come off of their property tax statement the next year. Well, I'm not sure I understand the concept of when you ask about a landowner application.
Well, Mr. Chairman, so what you're saying is that this bill does not cost the landowner any money.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hackbarth, in the sense of it costs the landowner money because the proceeds that pay for the construction or pays for an improvement or pays for the maintenance repair of a drainage system is borne by all of the lands that drain into and benefit from the ditch that's there. That's the drainage benefit that they've derived. That landowner where the buffer strip is being required is likely going to pay a small amount, but other people who are maybe 2 miles away that also benefit because they've got tile that is draining into, and that drainage ditch serves as an outlet for their drainage and is allowed for that improved drainage, is also paying for it. And the concept, again, is to reduce future maintenance and to protect water quality through having the strips done in. This is simply a way to provide the drainage authority without having to go through a more costly, full-blown redetermination of benefits and damages, a means to have them to be able to voluntarily be more proactive and promote the establishment of grass buffer strips where they determine they're going to provide both either a water quality benefit or reduce long-term maintenance, which goes right back to the landowners anyway. So there is some, in some respects, it's to their benefit to not having to have that ditch cleaned out quite as frequently.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'm still not getting to the answer that I'm looking for. What's it going to cost a farmer that is not in compliance now to get this bill taken care of? I mean, to comply with this bill.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hackbarth, I apologize if I'm not making it clear. When this would be implemented by a drainage authority, if the landowner has got 1 acre of buffer strips on their land, and the viewers or the engineer says that land is currently valued at $3,500 an acre, they're going to get a check for $3,500 an acre. The money for that, and that's going to be for that strip along every one of those property owners, along the ditch, they may also pay as part of their normal maintenance levy, which is an annual levy that, or a levy that's done by the drainage authority, to those. That levy might be $6 or $7 an acre for all of their property that is benefited by it. So the net effect is they're going to get paid for the strip, and they may have for that same acre a $6, $7, or $8 per acre maintenance cost that everybody else is paying. So is it a full compensation? Maybe not. Maybe just a little bit less.
Thank you. Representative Dill, did you have a question? Please proceed.
Okay, section, as we look at Section 5 of the old bill, that now becomes the new Section 5, which is the Hansen Amendment, which talks about the ditch buffer strip annual reporting. And basically what that language does is just requires the drainage authorities to annually submit a report to the Board of Water and Soil Resources, which would include the number and types of actions for which viewers are applying, the number of miles of buffer strips established according to 103E. So when one of those proceedings take place that requires it, they'll report to us the number of miles that were established, the number of drainage inspections that were conducted, and then the number of violations. And the other amendment, the 07-0058 amendment, would add after violations also enforcement. So it would be the number of violations and enforcement actions that relate to Section 103-021, which is the grass buffer strip requirement only. So then in the renumbering, the old Section 5 becomes the new Section 6, and that refers to damages which are paid again to the landowner. The major change here is that it makes it clear in statute that if the drainage authority is doing a repair procedure or an improvement and they're placing that spoil onto land that's in a federal or state conservation program, CRP, RIM, land that might be enrolled in an environmental quality incentive, but anyways, land that's in there, we've had some county attorneys provide opinions to their drainage authorities that they have no obligation to restore that vegetation if it's in a state or federal program. We think it makes sense that the landowner is not put in jeopardy of having the Farm Services Agency or the local soil and water district come out and say, guess what? You've got this spoil out there that hasn't been seeded down, and now you're in violation of your CRP contract or your RIM easement. This makes it clear that that as drainage authorities look at their responsibility, it does include any damages that occur to those conservation program lands that may be adjacent to a ditch. The old Section 6, which becomes the new Section 7, is basically, again, conforming language. The old Section 7, which is the new Section 8, is a provision which, again, reinforces that when a drainage system disturbs or destroys perennial vegetation or practices associated with, again, those federal or state conservation program lands, that it is a responsibility of the drainage authority to pay that landowner, either restore it themselves or pay them for that damage so that they can then get the reseeding done or the revegetation done according to the conservation plan that governs that parcel. The old Section 8, which is the new Section 9 of the bill, the change there, besides the conforming change of changing grass to permanent strips of perennial vegetation, is adding a requirement that drainage ditches, open drainage ditches, are inspected at a minimum of once every 5 years in regards to the grass buffer strip. So it adds, before the basically the law said that you shall maintain the system and provide for regular inspection, this defines that it's at least once every 5 years. And then the old Section 9, which is the new Section 10, is conforming language. The old Section 10 and the new Section 11, again, those are conforming language there with taking care of the grass and replacing it with perennial vegetation. And the old Section 11 and the new Section, which would be the new Section 12, again, is conforming language. And at that point, I'm going to end. That covers basically the policy portions of the bill. And as Representative Hansen said, those are policy changes that the Board of Water and Soil Resources and the Governor's Office support and were provided to them by us during the budget process. And with that, I'll switch over and let Representative Hansen touch on the appropriations.
Thank you, Doug. And maybe just before I start on that, I wanted to point out that this whole process, this bill, came about through the hard work of many of the people in the room today, representing organizations very broadly who often may not get along with each other or agree with each other, but came together on these consensus recommendations. Drainage law has developed over a long period of time, 100 years, and we're looking at some incremental changes here based on the report that we heard in this committee a couple weeks ago that buffers along drainage ditches enhance wildlife, protect water quality, and reduce erosion. And they also reduce having to do the maintenance more often. So what we have in the bill here is clarifying the buffer language. We have reducing some of the process that's involved in order to get buffers established on the land. Getting buffers established on the land then helps reduce those costs involved over the long run, in addition to having the benefit of protecting water quality, providing wildlife habitat, and reducing erosion. Under the appropriations provision, and earlier I think we had received the Board of Water and Soil Resources change items, Subdivision 1 in the bill, the dollar figures that are in here were what the task force recommended through the process of working through a year. The governor's office does have some differences with those, and I want to make sure that folks are aware of those. Subdivision 1 has $2 million appropriation from fiscal year 2008. The change item for the Board of Water and Soil Resources is $0.5 million. Under item B, line 6.19, the $150,000 appropriated in fiscal year 2008 from the general fund, that is the same in the change item for the Board of Water and Soil Resources. Under Subdivision 2 Drainage Manual Update, you will see $300,000 appropriated from fiscal year 2008 from the general fund. the Board of Water and Soil Resources change item has ongoing funding of $300,000 per year to fund three permanent Bowser staff positions who would work on Subdivision 2, Subdivision 3, and Subdivision 4 as they're numbered. So that's the difference between the, and at some point the bill will move to the Finance, Environmental Finance Committee, where we'll continue to work on those items. So with that, walking through the bill.
Representative Wagenius.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman and Representative Hansen and Mr. Thomas. I have an amendment in the packet, but I'm not going to offer it, but I would like to just let you know my thinking about the amendment and my concern. And my concern is that we are still using the language permanent grass other than a noxious weed, and that may be vegetation, it may be trees, but it's nonetheless permanent grass other than a noxious weed. So the range of stuff that can be planted under this is huge. And I will just use the example of reed canary grass, which is one of my least favorite plants, and probably the least favorite plants of a whole bunch of folks. It's not a noxious weed under statute, as I understand. So my neighbor, and I do have neighbors, could plant reed canary grass under this language. Well, that reed canary grass is not going to stay there. It's going to come over and get into my prairie that I'm trying to restore. In fact, the biggest problem I have in prairie restoration is reed canary grass, something I never planted but is there. So not to have something that protects the neighbors in another way is concerning to me. And, of course, we're sitting on the committee that's looking after wildlife, and reed canary grass is just lousy for wildlife. But I suppose the most critical thing for me right now is, what are you doing to your neighbors? By planting something that can move, they will have to spray, they will have to deal with, and so I'm really concerned about our thinking about vegetation as in the past.
Mr. Thomas. Chair, Representative Wagenius, at the board, with our wetland restoration programs and many of our things, we obviously share the same concerns about the invasive species, and in fact do not allow those and require, because there's a state investment in those projects, we do have a requirement that they have to use native plants, as you described, and also that are of a local origin. I think just to touch on a little bit from the work group's perspective, and that's the perspective that I'll try to share, is we did begin to have a little bit of this discussion at the very end of the process. The work group did agree that it was an issue that should be talked about, and feel that it's something that if this bill passes and funding's available and there's a continuation of that group of interests that include both ag, conservation, environmental organizations, and the drainage authorities, to continue to commit to that discussion. The work group does support the amended language, which includes that preference that should be given, or acknowledgement in looking at that. Also recognizing these are difficult sites in terms of where they're located, and many times there's disturbed soils. They do remain in private ownership, with the option available to the landowner for annual harvesting of those. And so the kinds of things that are planted out there now are not reed canary grass. They're kind of the normal hay mixtures that you might find, which would be cool season grasses and legumes, or it might be something on the order of where they're recommending using a MnDOT roadside mix that would be widely and commercially available for contractors to purchase and to seed those areas. And I think the other thing, with the updating of the manual, we have an opportunity to begin to use that and some of the training and education that can occur to begin to identify and provide some of those recommendations on native species that we can, you know, look at and show have proven to do well in really some very difficult situations, because much of that spoil that's placed there is disturbed. It's oftentimes subsoil. It's not, you know, the top A horizon of the soil profile anymore, and it does present some difficulty. Also, right now, the need to get quick establishment to prevent erosion from occurring, and having that stuff end up kind of washing right back into the ditch. And so those are some of the things that I know that the work group, you know, had some discussion around. And I think it's really why they're at a point where they support the inclusion of the language that we have in front of you, which is that preference should be given to it, and acknowledging that there's more work to be done on the part of drainage authorities to develop and create more support for maybe in the future a little bit more aggressive approach in statute to what is allowed or permissible.
Representative Wagenius.
Thank you. I just want to note that part of all of the work that's done around drainage ditches is looking out for your neighbor. I mean, that's the premise of all of this. And as we are being neighborly, I'll tell you, MnDOT mix is not what I would see as a neighborly thing to do, because it's going to move over and I'm going to have problems. So just as we're looking at a new, we've been hearing all this discussion about from Dr. Tillman, I hope you all can use what he has done and incorporate that into what you're doing to see that that's actually an opportunity for folks to think differently, to have a resource that they could actually sell. This language still allows reed canary grass. So.
Any further questions? And Representative Hansen.
Mr. Chair, I do have, I don't know if the page has handed out the letters of support for the bill. We do have someone who has driven in would like to testify. Mr. Alan Parrish, who is a viewer and with Farmers Union. I don't know if Tom Peterson is going to be speaking, but Alan is very important, Representative Hackbarth, because Representative Watremba said if Alan's not happy, I'm not happy. So Alan's very important, so I think I want to hear from him.
Mr. Parrish. And if you could state your name for the record, please. Thank you for joining us.
Alan Parrish. I'm from Burrville, Minnesota. That's in Todd County. I am a landowner or a farmer. I do have a drainage system on my farm that runs probably well over a mile on my property. I also, like Mr. Hansen stated, I am a member of Minnesota Farmers Union and a Minnesota Viewers Association member.
Thank you, Mr. Parrish. Any comments on the
I was part of the work group study group, and I didn't attend all the meetings, but I did attend several of them, and this is, like all drainage, is probably a work in progress, and I see no real problems with it as it's written, and the amendments that I've seen today, I think will only enhance its being a good working document.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Parrish. Any questions at all for Mr. Parrish or anyone else? Would anyone else like to testify, either for or against? Okay, seeing no further discussion, there is an amendment before us. Representative Hackbarth, would you like to move your amendment, please?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Let's see, where's my amendment? What's the number of that?
0026.
I'd move the amendment, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Hackbarth moves amendment A07-0046. Representative Hackbarth, to your amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. What the amendment is, members, is strictly, simply, what this bill originally started out to be, Representative Hansen. We were talking about trying to figure out exactly where the ditch starts and where it ends and where the buffer strip should start and where it should end. And if the task force was going to look at that and try to come up with a determination as to where that should be, I think that's what you came up with. That's what's in your bill. And Representative Hanson, that's what I've done. I've taken from House File 577 your description of how you figure out where these grass strips or permanent vegetation strips, whatever they might be called, how they're going to be determined and what's the width and how you figure out where they're going to be. That's pretty much what my bill does. It gets rid of all this other stuff that's in the bill that I think we've got statute after statute on how to do some of these things already, Mr. Chairman and members. If you look in the statute book, there's page after page after page about how to figure these things out and how to enforce these things and regulations on ditches. I think with the appropriations that are in this bill, this goes way, way beyond what this thing intended to be originally. And my bill just simply gets down to the brass tacks of how do we figure out where the ditch starts and ends, where do the grass strips or permanent vegetation strips start and end. And we take that from the task force recommendations, and that's what the amendment is. It just deletes everything else, and that's what the amendment is, members.
Thank you, Representative Hackforth. Any questions or comments to the amendment?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hanson.
I appreciate Representative Hackforth's efforts to try to go back to the original intent. I think the opportunity we've had here is a lot of folks have worked a long time on compromise language that and funding. When they look at this issue and look at the complexity of drainage, and I will admit it is complex. There are complex terms, there are complex language, there's a complex history. It is very complex. And you've had a lot of people working for a long time last year looking at this complexity and trying to make it easier. Some of the language that is stricken with the amendment I think is very critical. Actually reduces some of the regulation and allows for greater establishment of buffers. So I would oppose the amendment.
Any further questions or comments? Seeing none, Representative Hackforth renews his motion to pass Amendment A07-0046. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, nay.
No.
Motion fails. Amendment is not adopted.
Representative Hanson, to renew my motion to pass House File 577 as amended and refer it to the local government committee.
Representative Hanson renews his motion that House File 577 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Local Government and Metropolitan Affairs. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Amendment bill is passed. Recommended pass. Thank you. And next on the agenda, we are going to be hearing a division report from the Division of Game, Fish, and Forestry. There are three bills that have been sent to us, or three reports. What I'd like to do is to move to adopt all the division reports at once so that we get them all before us at once and we don't have to go through and make this motion every time. We're still going to have the opportunity to hear each bill separately, and we will have an opportunity to amend or do anything with the bills that we would like at that point. I just want to know if there's anyone that has any problems with that. It's just to speed up the process a little bit. Yes,
Representative. I don't know if I just followed what you said. So the initial motion would be to accept the division reports. I understand that. But then you'd be moving each bill separately. Is that correct?
Exactly, Representative Finkelstad. Yes. Yes. Any other questions or clarification?
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move adoption of the Game, Fish, Forestry Division report for February 12th, which included House File 260, 354, and 152.
Representative Dill moves to adopt the division reports for House Files 260, 354, and 152. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All those opposed? Motion prevails. division reports have been adopted. Now we'd like to take up each of the bills separately, and then we'll send them on to their next destinations. The first bill, I would like to move House File 260. First committee engrossment be recommended to pass. And this is Representative Kalin's bill, veterans exempted from requirement of firearm safety certificate. Representative Kalin, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess I'll follow your lead in terms of how we want to do this most expeditiously. Just a brief summary of the bill, I guess.
Brief summary of the bill, Representative Kalin. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members. I actually direct you to the bill summary that Mr. Cleary from House Research has prepared and included in your packet. It's a very thorough discussion, I think, for a one-pager of the issue. Firearm safety certificates are actually an issue that I think will come before this committee and certainly before the division a little more probably this year. But in essence, in short, my bill would exempt veterans from the shooting requirement, the shooting and field requirement of the firearm safety certificate. It would still require that they go through the whole wildlife ID and the hunting ethics portion. There is a provision available right now online, and you'll see in the bill that the IHEA, International Hunter Education Association, online course is easily linkable from the DNR website and is accepted by almost all states in the country. And I actually zipped through it myself. I spent about 2.5 hours going through it very quickly to kind of check it out. And so if you're really doing it properly, as most veterans do read every single word that they're given in front of them, it's very thorough and would take several hours. And I'll also just point out, I spoke with Bob Meyer from the DNR, and the language you have in front of you represents a compromise between our desire to honor our veterans and not put an undue burden on them, but also make sure we have the safest hunters out in the field, and appreciate the firearm safety instructor volunteers who are in the audience today as well, and appreciate their input on the bill.
Thank you. Any questions for Representative Kalin? Representative Tingelstad.
Mr. Chair, I guess I missed your motion. Where's the bill going next?
The motion is going next to... it's going to the General Register.
So, Mr. Chair, to follow up then, Representative Kalin, is this going to the Veterans Committee, or where has it been heard so far? I'm trying to follow track for this legislation here.
Representative Kalin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Tingelstad, good question, and sorry for not detailing its history. Actually, originally was referred to Ag, Rural Economies, and Veterans Affairs, and then after speaking with the chairs with all four chairs, we decided that actually Representative Dill's committee was the most appropriate way to hear it, and have spoken thoroughly with all chairs and many members of the committees. And the one time-sensitive situation here is just that there are a few over-the-counter spring turkey licenses that may still be available in a couple of other situations that we just want to make sure that any veteran has access to their hunting license from here forward. So we're hoping to get this passed before the spring turkey hunt, if we can.
Okay. Representative Tingelstad.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Kalin, thanks for doing this legislation. Mr. Chair, I do see that we have somebody in the audience who might want to testify. I don't know if you're going to bring in more testimony.
Yes, we will. And Representative Wardenius.
Yes, just a question here on your when you say a person who successfully completed basic training in the armed forces would include the Navy and the Coast Guard. Do they have shooting requirements, range and shooting requirements in their basic training now, and does that include officers too?
Representative Kalin.
Thank you, Representative Eakin. Representative Wardenius, I believe so, and I've actually spoken with nearly all veterans who are current members and veterans of and many active duty and veterans as well, and they, to the best of my knowledge, my answer is yes, but that doesn't, I'm not going to put my entire life savings on that answer. And I would just like to add, Mr. Chair and Representative Wardenius, that this doesn't bar someone from going to, and I'd like to actually take one step back first, that only those who are born after December 31st, 1979 have this firearm safety certificate requirement, and this does not bar someone from going. I'm actually going to, before I get my deer license this fall, I'm actually going to go through this course, even though I don't have to, because it's just sparked a real interest in it, and I want to make sure that I am indeed following the safest guidelines that we can, even though I've handled a firearm dozens and dozens of times. So it doesn't exempt someone, or doesn't bar someone from actually going to do the training. I think it just says, I had a constituent who served 7 years in the U.S. Army, including a stint in Tikrit, and was actually then denied his deer hunting license 8 months after coming home because he didn't have a firearm safety certificate.
Representative Williams.
I think that wasn't my worry, though. My real question was, do all the armed forces have shooting range portion of their basic training, both as either as an officer or as an enlisted person? And that's just my question. You can answer that later.
Representative Moe, I think, has a response to the question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Guinness brings up a good point. However, there is no military personnel in the state of Minnesota, or United States for that matter, that doesn't have thorough firearms training that far surpasses the training that's required for a firearm certificate. So it would be more hours for every single person that applies and not less.
Thank you, Representative Moe. And Representative Kalin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Not to speak too much on the subject, but one of the things that did surprise me is the shooting requirement is actually shooting a .22 caliber 15 times. So going through that exercise doesn't necessarily make one competent. Like I said, I think this sort of opened up a whole can of issues that I think we would like to address down the road, but I will get that answer for you specifically. I think someone in the audience may actually be able to give us a quick response as well. Is that what I was
saying? Yes. Thank you for joining us. If you could state your name for the record, please.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. My name is Jerry Kaiser. I'm the chairman of the United Veterans Legislative Council. I'm also a Vietnam veteran, two-tour crew chief and machine gunner, and all military, to answer the question, are all military officer or enlisted Army, Navy, Air Force, Marine, and Coast Guard all have extensive firearms safety training, and we all learn how to shoot. Our job is to, in most cases in the military, is to shoot folks and break things, and so we learn how to do that.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Kaiser. Any further questions? Any others that want Representative Mariani?
Mr. Chair, and I hesitate to ask questions because I'm totally ignorant of basic training requirements, and I'm not a hunter as well. But I note that the language says military personnel are not exempt from any other requirement for this section. I'm just trying to think of perhaps extreme situations where there may be physical issues that arise with a veteran that may impede their ability to successfully dispense a firearm. Is that covered by this provision?
Representative Kalin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Mariani. There is a disability section that addresses actually physical challenges in the firearm safety certificate requirement section that we're adding to.
So then, Mr. Chair, Representative Kalin, this language would not trump the physical requirements to be able to safely dispense a firearm. Is that correct,
Representative Kalin?
Correct, Representative Mariani. It would not. We drafted this as narrowly as we could. It was initially very broad, and through compromise brought it as narrowly as possible.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Tinglestad.
think, Mr. Chair, sorry to ask so many questions here, but you know, I serve as vice chair in the Veterans Committee, and since this is not going to be heard on any Veterans Committee or division, I just have a couple questions. So it mentions on line 8 and on line 15 about military personnel, but it doesn't ever mention veterans in here. So I guess I'm just looking at the definition. So they have to be currently in the military, or what's the line between, does this work for veterans, somebody who has been discharged?
Representative Cornish.
We brought this up in committee the other day. The reason we like it, military personnel instead of veteran, if you put veteran, you're going to restrict all the National Guardsmen out that haven't been deployed, because National Guardsmen, thousands of them in the state, if they haven't been employed for over 180 days, even though they've completed basic training, wouldn't meet the qualification of a veteran. So that's why it's military personnel.
Thank you, Representative Cornish.
Just
Representative Finkelstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Callan, I'm just wondering about the status of this in the Senate. Is there a Senate chief author? Does it have a bill number? Is it moving through committee? Since there's an urgency that you defined, what's happening in the other body?
Representative Kalin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the question, Representative Finkelstead. Representative Tony Laurie has been actually holding on to the jacket, sort of. He spoke with one of his chairs and has sort of been working through the process and wanted to give us an opportunity just to refine the language and sort of go through it once and see if we can perfect the bill as closely as possible. And when I spoke with him this morning, and he looked at the language, he feels really comfortable and we'll drop it. We'll introduce it in the next week or so, and we'll have to do a little bit of lobbying to, as we process and don't always line up between the two bodies. And so we'll have to figure out exactly how we're going to get it done. But I think there's a, I've actually spoken to well over 200 people who've contacted me about this issue through email, phone call, or actually stopping by in person, expressing their thanks for carrying this bill, and Representative Severson and Hawes have also carried similar legislation. So the need is out there. We want to make sure we don't send this message to veterans that we don't trust them with a gun in the woods, but trust them to lay down their lives with an M16. So I'm cautiously optimistic.
Representative Tinglestead.
Follow up then. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Cal. I see you have quite a few House authors, and I'm glad to see that, and bipartisan. I really encourage you to work with the Senate author. You know, usually a bill is not heard on the House floor until or unless it's gone through some kind of action in the Senate. So if there's indeed urgency with this, you know, maybe advice from the freshman orientation leader to one of the freshmen, you better sit at the doorstop of the senator and get him to drop it in the hopper, because, you know, it's kind of like you're sending one message and something else is being received as far as the urgency piece. Thank you.
Appreciate that.
Yeah. Thank you, Representative Finkelstead. Any other questions? Anyone else from the audience that would like to testify, either for or against? Yes, sir. Thank you for joining us, and state your name for the record, please.
For the record, my name is Stephen Morin. I'm here as a volunteer safety instructor for the Minnesota program. After talking with Representative Callan after the last hearing, I'm very pleased with the language in the current bill. I do have some, just a couple of comments. Shoot people and break stuff. The exact antithesis is what we teach in our class, and that's part of why we felt so strongly that a face-to-face meeting with a veteran is so important for the volunteer instructors of the state of Minnesota, and I'm pleased to see that's in here so that we can actually make that evaluation. An example, military fence crossing is simply sling the rifle over your shoulder and get over the fence. There's a very strong set of guidelines on how to do it in a hunter safety class. It's those little things. We have to do things 8 times to learn them, 28 times to unlearn them, because you have to do it the right way 20 times to unlearn what you were taught before, and then 8 to do it the correct way. So I'm pleased to see we have a face-to-face meeting. I'm looking forward to veterans coming to me with their online coursework and administering final exams. I will admit it did seem a little odd to take a 20-year Marine Corps veteran, phone them out on a mat and hand them a .22 caliber rifle and 15 rounds of ammunition and say, please impress me. To give you a little background, the field exercise is not so much a marksmanship qualification as it is a handling exercise. It's for us to observe them handling the firearm. And it is an opportunity for us to spot bad habits. And we've been trained to do that very quickly. Experience has taught us what to look for. Not necessarily in a shooting exercise. When we're on the range, we're not watching the targets, we're watching the students. That's what the shooting exercise is all about. We can do that informally in a classroom with a veteran in 5 minutes of conversation and at the instructor's determination. But I am pleased to see that we are still getting that face-to-face time and administering the final exam under this current language. The only other concerns that I have, I've been told you're already aware of, Representative Callen, is that the we want to make sure that these safety certificates, when issued, because of this exemption, it doesn't jeopardize the reciprocity agreements with other states. If we're going to issue them a safety certificate, I don't want them to have it denied when they go out to Wyoming for their once-in-a-lifetime elk hunt. I'd like to see those certificates valid in all 50. And lastly, there is some federal funding tied to the Hunter Safety Course. I'm not sure where that funding comes from. I believe it's Pittman Robertson monies. It's probably substantial. You want to make sure you're not jeopardizing any of that money. And as I say, I've been told that the bill authors are aware of these issues, and I'm sure they'll work those out as it works its way through the process. Thank you.
Thank you. And is it Mr. Morin?
Yes.
Yes, thank you. Any further questions or comments? Okay, seeing no further questions or comments, I'll renew the motion that House File 260, the first committee engrossment, be recommended to pass. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? Motion prevails. Recommendation is to pass. Next, Representative Nornes will be Thank you for joining us, I'll move House File 152, First Committee Engrossment, to be recommended pass and be referred to the Committee on Finance with a recommended re-referral to the Committee on Environment and Natural Resources Finance Division. Now, thank you for joining us, Representative Nornes, to your bill.
Okay. I'll make this brief because it's a very brief bill. For those of you that have been here for a while, you have heard a lot of talk about fees. And for the senior citizens, they went from a free license to a full-fledged $17 license like everyone else. So this bill, basically, in fairness to the seniors who have complained, frankly, a little bit about that, it's a compromise. They did ask for a free one, at least the seniors I talked to, and I felt the legislature probably wouldn't go there again. So again, I had two compromises. Once, the first one was a half price. We're giving them a half price deal, so the $850 for a license. And I also raised the limit. Instead of 65, I went to age 70. So trying to again make everybody feel that this is going to work out. I tried to lessen the impact on the DNR and the fishery budget, and also tried to address the fact that the seniors want to fish and feel that they weren't comfortable paying full price. That's the deal.
Okay. Representative Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Nornes, do you have an idea what kind of an impact this will have on the DNR's budget? Have you determined that by ages of people who take out licenses, et cetera?
We had a fiscal note at the first hearing, but it was based on age 65. And since I amended it to 70, I've not had an updated fiscal note on that. So I don't have an answer for you at this time.
Representative Scalzi.
And what was that at age 65, just so I can kind of get an idea?
Frankly, I didn't bring that information along, so I don't have it available at this time. Maybe someone else does.
Yes. Welcome to the committee. If you could state your name for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. I'm Ed Bogus, Deputy Director of Fish and Wildlife for DNR, and
at age 65, at the current rate of license purchases, Representative Scalzi, we estimated the fiscal impact would be about $730,000 a year.
Okay, thank you. Representative Cornish.
I don't really care for the bill that much, Representative Nornes. It's, I know we're in the policy section, but I think it's bad policy and bad finance, and plus we got a pot of money to dip into. The I would rather see a free fishing license given to veterans. I mean, us older guys, all we're doing is getting old. At least they went over and risked their lives, and we've tried that before with no luck with veterans.
Representative Cornish, some of these folks could be veterans, too.
Sure, they could be, but it... Our older people right now had the fishing when it was its best. It's actually degraded from what it used to. They fished in the best years, and they fished when the licenses were down, and this is the cheapest entertainment you can get. You fish 365 days of the year for 20-some dollars. I mean, you spend that in one night on a meal. So unless there's and it's an ongoing thing every year where the money's going to be missing. So I know I'm not going to make a lot of people on ARP very happy by saying that, but...
Any other comments or questions? Representative Osmond.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chairman. As an ARP member, and I haven't reached age 70 yet, but I do know how difficult it is to provide funding for our resources, and as a retired person, I plan to take advantage of fishing opportunities much more than I've been able to do as a younger person, and I don't think that's a time for us to start to cut back on providing the dollars to maintain those resources. And so I think it's just fair that those that get more fishing opportunity at least help pay for an equal for to the young people who don't have the same fishing opportunities. It's not fair to push all that resource responsibility over onto them. So I would also oppose this on policy basis.
Well, thank you, Representative Osmond. And as a future ARP member, I may be interested in taking advantage of future fishing opportunities. And one concern, too, I think that a number of individuals, when they become senior citizens and retire from their employment, oftentimes living on fixed incomes, and so that can also make it difficult. But Representative Nornes, any further comments or...
I don't really have anything additional to add, except that I'm not quite as convinced as the other testifiers are that the seniors fish that much on the lake, that we happen to have a cabin. The folks that live there don't fish much, even those that are younger. And so I question the impact, basically, I question the impact on the DNR's fisheries budget by going to age 70. I'd like to see a fiscal note to I think the number we heard again was based on 65, and I think at age 70 the drop, you'd start to see a natural drop anyway because of a number of reasons why folks would stop fishing. So I missed that.
I said my dying.
Well, I don't want to get that specific, but so I understand there's some opposition, and you know, if you don't want to push this any further, it's not going to be the worst thing that's ever happened to me. So it's your decision to make.
Representative Tinglestad.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Nornes. I don't know if you know, or maybe it's somebody from DNR. The neighboring states, what's the rate for somebody age 70 to fish in, like, Wisconsin or Iowa?
I do not know. I assume somebody might. Apparently not. I'm guessing it's higher. I don't know.
Representative Osmond, did you have a...
Here comes an ARP member.
Mr. Chair, Representative Jelly sent me a card once, but I don't think I'm a member yet. Mr. Chair, Representative Tingle said, we don't have that information readily available. We can look into that and get that back to you. And also the costs. Interesting note, though, is as we deal with the recruitment and retention issues that we're so concerned about,
The one area where they are, we do see some growth, is in 64 years olds and above. So there is some growth there, and I think we've had some major concerns about the fiscal impacts of this provision, what it will do to the Game and Fish Fund, and our ability to do the fisheries management that comes off of the, related to that fund. So we'll get to some of the new numbers, or Mr. Chair.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Meyer, and Representative Moe.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Norris, I'm not going to make you stand alone here.
I appreciate your support.
Yeah, I shared this the previous committee. You know, I volunteer for Let's Go Fishing, and it's a great program the state supports, and we go get seniors from Gold Pine, another nursing home and assisted care facility from the Bemidji area, many of which are on fixed incomes, very low fixed incomes. And for a few of these people, it would make a difference in whether they go fishing or not. And I've seen I've been with them, I've seen the expressions on their faces when they've spent a day fishing, and it's the first time they've done it in 10 years. And what a difference that makes to them. So I know there's going to be a cost. Mr. Meyer, let us know that. You know, I advocate that we pass this out of here and send it to finance and see how much money we can squeeze out of that that committee. So you got my support.
Thank you, Representative Osmond.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Trying to respond to Representative Dornis, so you know I've been passionately opposed this type of thing for years, so it has nothing to do with you or your proposal.
I understand.
It is just truly with the resource. I do not have difficulty with the exceptions that Representative Moe has outlined. If this is one-time thing or a limited time period or whatever, that's very different than what I see before me. Right now, this is saying everyone over age of 70 automatically gets a reduced price regardless of how often they go out there. If we're talking about making some opportunities for senior citizens in nursing homes or, you know, just like we do for youth or whatever, that's a whole different subject and would gladly discuss, you know, that type of an approach. This is very different and really does impact on the resource. I've been in conversations with Representative Wagenius today as to where do we find money for, you know, just to assess our waters and try to come into compliance with Clean Water Act and so forth, and then to have our actual resources that we need to maintain take away the fee that people should be paying, and then have, but yet the resource has to be maintained, so it then ends up the obligation of the general fund. And so it's not like this is free money. It's not free money. Somebody's going to pay for it because the resource has to be protected and has to be provided for, and DNR is going to do that one way or another. And so I'm all for special type of arrangements that do not have significant impact on the budget, but this one really does impact much broader, I think, than some may recognize at first brush.
Mr. Chair, if I could make two things. Number one, the Park Service, the DNR, lowered the fees at our state parks for the very reason to increase the use of our state parks. You could make an argument that by lowering the fishing fee, the fishing license, you're going to increase some sales. Because I know some senior citizens that have quit. They just, out of the principle of the thing, they just don't fish anymore. I don't know if that's true or not. But the other thing I'd point out, I don't know if I particularly like the way we fund the fisheries. I like people to tell me that fish are out there, and I have people telling me they aren't catching fish anymore. So I would like to probably suggest that we fund the fisheries properly without having this up and down based only on fishing license routine as another separate from this bill. But it seems to me that if we're really serious about having fish in our 10,000 lakes, we ought to put some money then where our mouth is. So again, it's sort of related to this but not directly, and so I'll leave it up to the committee to decide how they want to go.
Representative Cornish.
If I could make a suggestion, is it possible we either lay it over till we get more information or pass it on without recommendation on to finance? One of those two. because there's a lot of variables here. I think in nursing homes, as mentioned, they can already fish free in an organized event. I think if they put all their names on a piece of paper, mail it into the state, we used to be at our nursing home, and everybody could fish free. We'd put them on a pontoon, suit them up, take them out. So I just wondered if we had just, rather than pass it out of here, you know, just pass it out without recommendation or laid over.
One more comment in relation to what Representative Cornish mentioned. I understand there's a liability issue now, so that isn't being done anymore either, not because of the cost of the fishing license, it's because it's too risky. So that's another issue that prevents some of these activities from happening. So we hate to throw more problems out here, but that's a fact.
And Representative Norris, do you have a preference as far as what path this bill takes, whether we lay it over for?
I'm fine if you want to pass it on without recommendations. We'd have time to at least get another fiscal note put together, and we have some facts to deal with.
Okay. Representative Hackmore.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd recommend that we pass the bill out of here today to the Finance Committee like we had planned, like the original motion stated. We've got many steps along the way to work on the bill. Let's send it to Finance, and we'll get it over to Representative Wagenius' committee, and we'll take a look at it. The DNR will have the physical note to us. We'll be able to look at it and make that judgment at that time. I'd recommend that we pass the bill out of here as you recommend.
Okay. Any further comments? Any further testimony from the audience? Seeing none, I will renew the motion that House File 152, First Committee Engrossment, be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Finance with a recommended re-referral to the Committee on Environment, Natural Resources, Finance Division. Yes, Representative Osmond.
Recommend the pass?
Yes. Any further discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Bill is recommended to pass.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Next, we have Representative Anzell.
And yet another ART member. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And I will move House File 354 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Finance for re-referral to Higher Education and Workforce Development Policy and Finance Division. Representative Anzell, welcome to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. House File 354 is about forestry. It's about information. It's about communication. It's about public awareness. It would require the commissioners of the DNR and DEED to work together to produce an economic impact statement when and if a timber sale proposed on state land is pulled. And the idea here is we want to build public awareness for what happens in the forested counties when sales don't go forward. As you know, northern Minnesota land ownership is a patchwork quilt, school trust fund lands, various other kinds of state lands, private lands. I happen to live in the Chippewa National Forest. There are pieces of state land within that. And oftentimes sales look like they're going to happen, and then for some reason, because of an easement issue or other issues, sales are pulled. And we think that it is wise to develop public support and awareness, and such a study would do that. This bill is supported by the Minnesota Forest Industries and the Timber Producers Association. Also, I've just learned it's supported by the Arrowhead Counties Association, and I have discussed this matter with Mr. Meyer at the DNR, and it's something that we continue to work on, and we will be refining as the process unfolds here. So I ask for your support, and I would be happy to try to answer some questions. Representative Dill.
Thank you, Chair Egan. Representative Manziel, you referred to the the language, let's say, in the middle of the bill, line 10, 11, in that neighborhood, about the timber harvesting being pulled. But I think that could happen, but is it true that this would also apply to lands that that might not be harvested for decades, that the department decides to not harvest the wood on for maybe decades, and that because of that decision, this would make this economic impact study kick in, and that and the results would then be known. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair and Representative Dill, thank you for correcting my oversight. You're absolutely right.
And so, Mr. Chair,
Representative Dill.
So, really, I kind of begin to when I first read the bill and sent it over to you. I thought that was exactly what you said, was that, you know, there was going to be a timber sale because it was next to federal land or some reason we decided not to cut it. But what this really begins, in the, my view, is kind of a no-net loss of timber harvesting opportunity on state land. It's kind of the beginning of that movement, so to speak. And kind of gives us a quantitative analysis of what happens as our forest gets fragmented, and I think that's the reason I support it strongly.
Thanks. Representative Moe.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In continuation of what Representative Dill said, you know, my understanding, too, is this would say if an entity chose to dedicate land for a different purpose other than timber production, which if it had been in rotation and now all of a sudden it no longer was going to be for whatever reason, then it would require this statement be done too, correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Moe, yes, you are correct. And again, it's about public awareness, economic impacts of decisions that we make, and building community and public awareness among all of the businesses and all the stakeholders in the forested area.
Mr. Chair, including money that no longer will be going to our schools. And
Mr. Chair, Representative Moe is referring to, of course, the Permanent School Trust Fund, and thank you for bringing that up. Representative Dill.
Well, that brings up, I think, Representative Moe, you were referring to, like, for example, I'm just confirming that I understand what you were saying, is that should someone decide that an SNA would be appropriate, or a wildlife management area, or some that then this economic analysis would kick in, and we'd understand the economic impact. However, I have a question for Mr. Meyer, based on what you said. Mr. Meyer, could you grace us with your? We'd like to see your ARP card, though.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dill.
Okay, on this bill, the way I see it drafted, would refer to only state-acquired lands and CONCON lands and things like that. The school trust specifically has the specific provisions under Article 11, Section 8, and to its management. And I don't think the department has the ability to withdraw lands from the school trust for timber harvesting arbitrarily. Because an SNA might want to be developed. Can you tell us about that, or a wildlife management area? Although I know certainly you have used those school trust lands to do that. I'm thinking about how that all really plays out in terms of the Constitution and your practices.
Mr. Meyer?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dill, the designations you speak of, wildlife management areas, scientific natural areas, are designated under specific processes that we have in statute. Now, they can encompass certain types of land, but what we try to do is, wherever possible, we're trying to do it more now, swap out the trust fund status on those lands. As you may be aware, we've just recently are in the process of completing all of the trust fund swaps out of the state park system. So we do have lands that we can generate income on for the school trust. The way we view this issue, I think we can deal with it within our planning process, first of all, provide that information. But also, there's a lot of different things dealing with the lands under the authority of the commissioner. It might be more appropriate, we're going to work with the author and others, to just focus on some of those trust fund lands that we do have
strict fiduciary responsibility for the management of them. So it's one of the issues I look forward to addressing as the bill progresses. But there are complications depending on the classification of land that do provide different management circumstances.
Representative Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Meyer, do you have an idea what this would cost to provide this economic impact statement? And I have another question after that. It's a two-part. What is the cost between you and I think it's Deed? And then the other one would be, what's the definition of local? I come from northern Minnesota, and local might mean a long distance. So I'm wondering, how far would you go with a local impact?
Mr. Mayor?
Mr. Chair, Representative Scalzi, those are both two good questions. As for the cost, we're still trying to determine what that fiscal impact might be, and it's something we'll discuss in Finance Committee once we get a better idea of that. And local, is a good question. We may have to put some parameters on this as this progresses, what that local impact is, distances. Certainly timber harvesting in this day and age, local has a different connotation than it was even 10 years ago, the transportation networks that we have and the road infrastructure. So I think we need to work on that issue as well.
Any further questions? Representative Tinglestad.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Enslick. I know the motion on this is to go to higher ed and economic development, and I'm assuming it will come back to environment finance at some point. Is that right? Okay.
Yes.
And I'm looking at lines 16 through 18 where it talks about the report and how it's submitted. This is a kind of a normal thing that the Government Operations Committee sort of looks at, and I know that this bill is going to be worked on with Mr. Meyer through the process here. I'd encourage you to rewrite that line there. Reports aren't usually submitted to the legislature. It usually is something like the chair and the lead minority member of the committees with jurisdiction over DNR and deed, and then you need to set a date by which those reports need to be done. But I'm just wondering about where the final stop for this will be. Do you envision that it would be in the omnibus environment finance bill? And maybe this is to Representative Wagenius. I don't know. Let's try the author first, Representative Enzo.
Representative Enzo.
Mr. Chair and Representative Tinglestad, I don't know the answer to that question. Much of it depends upon how this is shaped and reshaped. In the steps that we're going to be taking. I certainly take your suggestion about those last three lines, 16 through 18, and we will definitely modify those. But I don't know the answer to the final destination.
Sure. Thank you, Representative Enslick. So I would just hope that it would come back through environment finance, and I'm feeling a little uncomfortable today, moving bills forward that we know still need work on it. I mean, I know, deadlines have been announced, but as long as we would see it probably in environment finance again, I think that would help my comfort level on this. So thank you.
Thank you. Representative Reinhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Enslick, my question is, where the balance is here in terms of public awareness. I hear that your goal is public awareness on the economic impact, but when timber is withdrawn from harvesting, there's some environmental impacts involved in that analysis. And I'm wondering if there's a balance here in terms of full public disclosure about the patterns here for harvesting and withdrawal of timber. And does that question make sense?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Biner, you are certainly accurate that logging, forestry, the forest products industry, is an environmentally sensitive occupation and economic activity, especially in northern Minnesota. But my sense is that we do a lot of environmental impact. We do a lot of environmental analysis of what occurs in the forest products industry. but we don't do enough on the economic impact side to an area of our state whose economy is extremely fragile and extremely dependent upon natural resources. And so I would respectfully ask that we not add further complication to what is rapidly becoming an even more complicated piece of legislation.
Thank you. Any further comments or questions? Representative Gardner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Not to embarrass anybody, but is it Representative Enzels?
Mr. Chair and Representative Gardner, thank you. You're right. Thank you.
Any further comments or questions? Any testimony from the audience at all? Seeing none, I would renew my motion that House File 354 be recommended as to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Finance for re-referral to Higher Education and Workforce Development Policy and Finance Division. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All those opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you very much.
Bill is recommended pass. Representative Hackbar.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Earlier on Representative Hansen's bill, we had a number of amendments. And just for clarification of the committee members, is there a 24-hour rule or is there not?
There is a, Representative Hackbar, there is a 24-hour recommendation. And if the 24-hour recommendation isn't met, then members are asked to bring copies of the amendment to the meeting for the other members of the committee and for others who are interested in seeing copies of the amendment.
So, Mr. Chairman, it's primarily for copying purposes and having them on hand for other members so that our members know that they can bring copies enough for the audience and for the members on other bills. So there's not a 24-hour waiting period or a deadline to have them turned into the chair?
Yes, that is correct, and we are sharing the amendments. We want the amendments to be shared with both sides, both in the research and with the other members, so that everybody has a chance to see the amendments during the committee. So, yes. Any further comments or questions? With that, we'll be adjourning until Thursday, or until next Tuesday. Meeting adjourned.